Welcome to the Commentary Magazine podcast. Today is Tuesday, May 28th, 2019. I'm John Podhoretz, the editor of Commentary Magazine. With me, as always, senior editor Abe Greenwald. Hi, Abe.
Hi, John.
Associate editor Noah Rothman. Hi, Noah.
Hi, John.
And in Washington, senior writer Christine Rosen. Hi, Christine.
Hi, John.
So we are pulling back a little bit to examine the foundations and precepts of a story in the New York Times that reports on the supposed war on climate change being waged by the Trump administration. And what I want to do here is not take up the question of how severe is climate change or is it happening or something like that. I just want to take up what the climate change, the world of climate change science claims is its role and its necessary project as relates to federal funding and the federal government's relation to climate change. And I'm going to read some from the New York Times story in question, and then I will ask my colleagues here to examine the logic behind what is being said here, okay? Parts of the federal government will no longer fulfill what scientists say is one of the most urgent jobs of climate science studies, reporting on the future effects of a rapidly warming planet and presenting a picture of what the Earth could look like by the end of the century if the global economy continues to emit heat-trapping carbon dioxide pollution from burning fossil fuels. So it says here, James Riley, a former astronaut and petroleum geologist, has ordered, as head of the House, as head of the United States Geological Survey, has ordered that scientific assessments produced by his office use only computer-generated climate models that project the impact of climate change through 2040, rather than through the end of the century, as had been done previously. Scientists say that would give a misleading picture because the biggest effects of current emissions will be felt after 2040. Models show that the planet will most likely warm at about the same rate through about 2050. From that point until the end of the century, however, the rate of warming differs significantly with an increase or decrease in carbon emissions. Okay. Abe, let me just start here with the following. So according to this, the head of the United States Geological Survey wishes to have projections of the future impact of greenhouse gases and the like only for another through 20 years from now, as opposed to projecting what the Earth will be like 80 years from now, on the grounds that mysteriously, just after the 20 years, things will either get better or worse depending on how we act during these 20 years. Okay. What is wrong with this picture?
What's wrong with it is that there is absolutely no way to make these projections so far into the future based on looking around the world today. It does not take into account all the various things that will undoubtedly intervene between now and then and change the prediction, as predictions have always fallen prey to unforeseen developments.
Right. Okay, so Christine, this is 2019, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Okay, let's go back 100 years to 1919 and say that you had a panel convened by the White House to describe the conditions of the planet Earth in the year 2000 from what is going on in 1919. What's wrong with that picture?
Well, first of all, much of it would depend on the people who you're asking to make the projection and whether they tend to make worst case scenario projections and give you those, or whether they're going to give you more modest speculation and describe it as such. And I think that's, you know, the climate debate has been driven largely by worst case scenario projections. It's also, of course, a real science, the study of climate change, the study of what's happening around the Earth, the study of global warming. These things, there's real scientific work being done. But there's a separate political argument that's always gone on and has arguably dominated the debate ever since, you know, there's been a so-called Republican War on Science. Remember that book by Chris Mooney some years ago? So the political debate about climate change relies on worst case scenario projections from the climate change folks, and in some sense total denial on the other extreme. It's completely unproductive. But the idea that working scientists can tell us anything about what things are really going to be like on the ground in 100 years, that's poor science. That's projection. You can make projections, but you make them with the modest goal of trying to think through what we can do now that might have any effect at all, which is, you know, there are certainly a few things, but to have that be the driving force behind policies we're making today doesn't really sound like science. It sounds like politics.
Can I just bring up an example? So before the widespread use of automobiles, there was a real concern about what on earth cities especially were going to do about the increasingly intolerable levels of horse manure in cities, because that was the chief mode of transportation, and it was piling up, and it is toxic, and to say nothing about being disgusting. And that was, if you had projected the horse manure explosion into the future, you know, but imagine the waste of resources, by the way.
Right. So, Noah, just think about this. So in 1919, here are some of the things that no one could possibly have predicted. The splitting of the atom, the rise of the ability to fly into space, to place satellites into space, the internet. I mean, and there's 10,000 things that people in 1919 couldn't have imagined. Go back another 100 years. Imagine a person in 1820 trying to imagine what life would be like in 1900. This is before there were railways, before there was the internal combustion engine, before there was, I can't even think, you know, before there was, you know, subway service in cities, before there was, I mean, steam engine travel, which I think happened in 18, right, the Fulton's Ferry, right? I mean, bridge technology, tunneling technology. I mean, there is no way to imagine. We cannot really imagine what life is going to be like in 2100.
No, and there's a perception on the part of people who are hostile towards climate change activism is that there's some sort of nefarious conspiracy involved here, and it's not exactly true. What you're using here is a model. And model is only as good as the amount of variables that are contributing to it and the data that is put into it. And if there's garbage in, there's garbage out. The only advantage to projecting out 100 years in time, which makes it scientific and not just outright futurism, is the capacity of those models to demonstrate that there will be a 10% reduction in GDP growth and thousands of people's lives disrupted or killed as a result of this climate change, or substantially less dramatic effects over the course of a much smaller period of time. These projections that these assessments come up with are concerning, but they'd have much more weight and gravity if this movement was inclined to look at with some skepticism and self-introspection and criticism about the models that have failed to meet the projections that they were supposed to result in. In 1990, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, produced its first assessment related to rates of warming and temperature changes, and that was flawed in 2001. The IPCC's assessment about the severity of snowstorms did not materialize. The predictions that the Arctic would be ice-free by now have failed to manifest. And Abe, and not too long ago, you wrote about how it was a skeptical blogger who took apart the consensus opinion among scientists, not a peer review process, but just a guy with some time on his hands, who found that the rates of oceanic warming were exaggerated. And the scientific community said, you know what, you were right. We have an example of this in the form of peak oil. Really, not too long ago, in 2006, It was the general assessment that we would deplete the proven reserves of oil and natural gas on the planet in a relatively short period of time, and a straight line projection would result in ever increasing costs. Straight line projections are inherently fallacious, but that's what we're doing here.
Right. Why? Because in 2007, the technology to do hydraulic fracturing took place, and literally in 12 years, the United States has gone from an importer of 40% of its oil to a net exporter of oil. 40%. This is the United States. This is a $30 billion a year industry or something like that that came up out of nowhere. Obviously, if some of the things that, you know, the terms that we now think of in science fictional terms, fusion, whatever, cold fusion, stuff like that, that, you know, that once there was a fallacious report that we had discovered cold fusion had been discovered. But I mean, God knows. I mean, who knows? We discovered the Higgs boson. You know, we in the last 5 or 6 years, the God particle that incepts the matter out of nothingness. I mean, we don't know what on earth is going to come from all of this. And I think what's striking about the story that I read is this sentence. Okay, so what we have here is the following, where it says, models show that the planet will most likely warm at about the same rate through 2050. That's 30 years, okay? From that point till the end of the century, however, the rate of warming differs significantly with an increase or decrease in carbon emissions, meaning the model is subject to change depending on what happens over the course of the next 30 years with what happens with greenhouse gases. So even if you accept the theory of global warming or climate change or whatever, the model that they insist they must be allowed to do on government on the government's dime has no fixed point, because it all depends on what happens over the next 30 years and whether the rate of emissions changes or what. And again, that all goes to, you know, if somehow the electric car replaces the gas driven car and emission, you know, God knows how far emissions would drop if that's your gravest concern.
Well, and especially much of it depends on what India and China continue, the path they continue to take forward in their development, right? And how what they're doing about their own, the burden on the pollution that they bear globally. So that, I mean, if they are able to find cleaner energy sources earlier on, it could slow. If they don't, it could get worse. That's all. That these are pretty serious factors that have to be taken into consideration, which again speaks to the need for more modest projections rather than doomsaying ones.
Right. So again, another paragraph from the story. The administration's prime target has been the National Climate Assessment, produced by an interagency task force roughly every 4 years since 2000. Government scientists used computer-generated models in their most recent report to project that if fossil fuel emissions continue unchecked, the Earth's atmosphere could warm by as much as 8 degrees Fahrenheit by the end of the century. That would lead to drastically higher sea levels, more devastating storms and droughts, crop failures, food losses, and severe health consequences. Okay, so here's the thing. This model has been used. It has projected that with nothing changing, temperatures will rise, may rise 8 degrees Fahrenheit, okay? That's already been done. So is the idea that every 4 years you issue a report that says the same thing over and over using the same government model? Or is what you're doing, and the answer I think is yes, and the purpose of that is not scientific, it is political. It is to create the conditions under which the voters of the United States and the politicians of the United States decide that this is the single most important issue and the thing that you have to deal with, right? And I'm saying that's not science. That is advocacy. And it may, again, I think part of the issue here is that the people who believe in this and believe that this is, you know, the worst thing that will ever happen on Earth don't really care that it is not the scientific method as we understand it, as we have been taught it, because the ends justify the means here. What is important is frightening the public into action and not using the best information that you have and making clear that there are a range of possible changes, and that you cannot, as Noah said, you cannot make a direct line guess about where the future is from the present.
And part of why this smacks of eschatology is in part because of what Christine said regarding the, you know, the true emitters here, which is the industrializing nations, China and India most particularly, and that the activist class really doesn't have a prescription for their process, their industrializing process, or seem to care a whole lot about it. I mean, they do when they're pressed, but beyond that, it's really just, oh, well, maybe the Paris Accords, which anybody who's familiar with them knows were entirely toothless, entirely voluntary, and almost nobody adhered to their own standards. So it's not really an answer. It's much more about a focus, inward, a domestic focus, and it takes on a hint of original sin, as though it is some sort of penance for industrializing, for being an industrial nation in the 20th century, in the late 19th century, and the associated largesse and conduct of foreign policy that we associate with the colonial powers. That's really where it gets to if you press the activist on the issue for longer than a five-minute conversation.
Well, in any attempt to even discuss what we're discussing right now in terms of the validity of some of these projections and models, you're called a denier for simply asking the question. I mean, that's how polarizing the debate has become, and why so much of this, I mean, 80 to 90% of this discussion about climate change these days ends up as a political debate, not a scientific one.
Well, because it can't be a scientific debate because we're not all scientists, and we're not
exactly
in a position to debate the science, and nor are a lot of the people who claim to be scientists who can debate it. The person who was made the most fun of in this piece is a famous scientist from Princeton, James Happer, who does say an absolutely horrendous thing in here where he compares, you know, the attack on CO2 to Jews under Hitler, which is, you know, terrible, and just like the demonization of the poor Jews under Hitler, which is an astonishing thing to say. And, you know, I hope that he is, basically slapping himself with a fish for having said it. I mean, it's horrible, and he should be disciplined for having said it, but it doesn't mean that he's not a creditable scientist who believes with some merit that there is a kind of, there is an idea that CO2 is evil, and that somehow the extirpation of it or the lessening of it or whatever you might call it is necessary to purify our system to make sure that it continues. And then, of
but
course,
not with the existing technology, with some sort of secret, super awesome future technology that, or maybe natural sources, renewables that will appeal to batteries that don't yet exist, but may exist in the future, because the technology that could mitigate CO2 emissions is nuclear. And when it's mm-hmm. introduced into the debate, the advocates for catastrophic climate change reject it out of hand, outright, and without any sort of debate around the issue. Biden did it, and yeah. It was called a half measure by AOC, a deal breaker, she called it.
Right, because basically everything is an echo of something older. I mean, I think one thing about, you know, approaching my 60th year is that I literally have now lived long enough to have lived through the idea that the Earth was overpopulated, and that it was really important for there to be zero population growth. And
that idea was over.
Well, we now live in the West, in a West that is depopulating because not of zero population growth, but of population growth below the replacement rate of 2, including in the United States, which is now understood to be a potential, you know, unholy disaster on the grounds that there are, you know, without generations behind to pay for the social services that an aging population is going to be seeking, we are going to be in a budgetary horror show. And that is something you can sort of project into the future, actually, because those numbers are knowable based on population trends and age and all of that. So there's zero population growth. There was nuclear winter. That was a big thing. Nuclear winter. You guys are, Abe, you guys aren't old enough to know how there were cover stories in news magazines about the horrors of nuclear winter. We were going to have a nuclear winter.
Oh, there the day after. Remember the day after that horrible TV movie?
Yeah, right. Yeah. So there was acid rain was another thing that we were destroying the Earth with acid rain, which turned out not to exist, really.
Hole in the ozone. The bee population.
The destruction of the rain, the lungs of the planet, the rainforest destroyed. Right. Like, every time you turned around, there was an ecological or environmental disaster that sort of faded because it wasn't really happening.
I would include the ozone hole in that one. I mean, that actually was addressed through public incentives,
fluorocarbons,
private incentives, chlorofluorocarbons.
Yeah, but it also had a seasonal component that when more fully understood, made it a much less pressing issue.
Yeah, and then remember the volcano that exploded in Iceland, right, in 2010, that it turned out then cooled the Earth for 5 years, as volcanoes will, as apparently was the story with the volcano at Krakatoa in the 1860s, which cooled the Earth for 30 years. I mean, maybe there's a cycle in which that stuff happens. You know, that's what I'm saying. You know, this is a vastly complex thing that nobody understands, except politically it turns out that this is too non-religious people, I would say. Not that there isn't a religious, not that you can't be a religious person and believe in the horrors of global warming or climate change. But it has within, as Noah said, an eschatological or religious aspect to it, that we are doing to the earth what, say, the people of Babel were doing, or what it was necessary for God to do to people when he made the flood, right? That we are besoiling humans are besoiling the earth and need all to be destroyed.
But if only it was just limited to, or if only it was so universally applied, but it really is the application of some sort of, and why it feels so religious is like, it's almost puritanical that there needs to be, when you get down to it, that there needs to be a sort of monastic life that we need to return to. The kind of consumerism that is fueling this is the problem, that we live too well and that the rest of the world suffers as a result of those. It's a finite commodity, prosperity, and we have too much and the rest of the world doesn't, and it needs to be redistributed. And so therefore a little bit of suffering on the part of Westerners, and exclusively Westerners, is not only a economic prescription but some sort of karmic justice.
Well, and that's a really important point that Noah's making, because it speaks to the reason why the environmental message has basically suffered a form of ideological capture by the left. And I think that, as we saw in the recent elections in Australia, that doesn't always lead to political success for people on the left when their message is one of fear-mongering and doom and gloom about climate. It doesn't always resonate with voters who are looking for more practical, sensible, dispassionate discussion of an important issue. It's not that if you're asking for reasonable, rational, scientific discussion without hyperbole, that doesn't make you a climate denier. If you don't understand the complexity of a model and want it explained in such a way that the doom and gloom projections make sense or don't, that doesn't make you a denier. And I think that there is this capture of the environmental message by the left, and that's actually as much the fault of the right as well. There's a real opportunity for a thoughtful conservative to make a stand on the environment that isn't climate denying and Trump-like, but that is sensible and dispassionate and much more rational and more of a realist stance on the climate than some of the fear-mongering we're seeing from the left.
I mean, there have been such things. Like 30 years ago, there was the policy of carbon trading, where you could you could essentially sell your carbon rights to somebody else and get a credit for not emitting carbon or something like that. George H.W. Bush promised to plant 1 billion trees. None of that availed him. Like, it's not as though it's not as though that kind of conservative environmentalism ends up winning any votes for the right, though it may mitigate the damage of being seen as being sort of hostile to the environment. But of course, I think in 2016 you saw almost the exact opposite happen, which is that the states that are the most at risk of having their economies injured by radical environmentalism went for Trump. Pennsylvania, Ohio, Michigan, Michigan in particular, like because of the kind of war on the auto on carbon emissions is itself a sort of war on the auto industry. Pennsylvania, which has a fracking industry that the Democrats were incredibly hostile toward. I mean, you have even the example of a state like West Virginia, which was a thoroughly Democratic state until the 1980s and is now the most Republican state in the country because of the attack on coal, which is its main industry. Now, you may hate coal. You may think that Hillary Clinton is right to say we should get rid of the coal industry. It's terrible. It's awful. It's bad for the people who work for it. It's bad for the environment, all of that. But, you know, this is a state in which it's a leading industry, and nothing has magically come along to replace it, so that there's no other form of much employment in West Virginia aside from the coal and its ancillary businesses, and so aside from selling, you know, opioids. So, you know, Democrats have been injured, I think, politically by their embrace of radical environmentalism. They leave a hole to make this kind of populist case that these clueless people who all live in cities and, you know, dance around in their elite, you know, places don't have any idea what it is that a real person has to go through to make a living.
I mean, the right's case for environmental remediation and CO2 emissions mitigation is pretty easy to make. I mean, it's just basically consumer demand and market forces. The bottom line is you get the environment that you pay for. This country has, in 2017, it led the world in CO2 emissions without any sort of non-binding treaty to do so, and that's just because people want it. The rates of emissions from coal burning have been reduced as coal burning has become economically inefficient as a result of, as we were talking about before, all these alternative fossil fuel technologies that burn cleaner and that are more abundant and have made coal less attractive. And then perhaps most recently and most importantly is the invention of smart thermostats, which have radically reduced the amount of wasted energy that goes into heating and cooling of structures. And the Green New Dealers say we need to mandate this technology and retrofit every building in the country in order to have it. But the only reason why it exists is market forces and consumer demand. And that's because people want to pay less in their utility bills.
Right. Okay. Now let's take a pause here so I can talk to you guys about DoorDash, which is a pretty great service because, you know, if you've had a long day at work or a tough day at school or you're still stuck at the office, you can treat yourself to the meal you deserve on demand from your favorite restaurants. Restaurants come to you with DoorDash. DoorDash connects you to all of your favorite restaurants in your city. Ordering is easy. Just use the DoorDash app and choose what you want to eat, and your Dasher will bring it right to you wherever you are. Not only is that burger place you love on DoorDash already, but over 310,000 other amazing restaurants are too. DoorDash connects you with door-to-door delivery in over 3,300 cities and all 50 states across the United States and Canada. Order from your local go-tos or choose from your favorite chains, Chipotle, Wendy's, Chick-fil-A, the Cheesecake Factory. Don't worry about dinner. Let dinner come to you with DoorDash. Right now, our listeners can get $5 off their first order of $15 or more when they download the DoorDash app and enter promo code commentary. That's $5 off your first order when you download the DoorDash app from the App Store and enter promo code commentary. Again, that's promo code commentary for $5 off your first order from DoorDash. So now that we have solved the Earth's problems, I just want to go back just for 1 second and emphasize this point. In 1720, okay, who predicted the American and French revolutions? Okay? Or, you know, I don't know, it's insane. I mean, 1919... who, you know, the Soviet Union had just been born. By 1991, it was gone. You know, Adolf Hitler was a World War I veteran in 1919. Like, you know, Joseph Stalin was one of the three people who might eventually succeed Lenin if the Soviet Union's government had survived.
This population is, control is the best argument for this, because it is a purely Malthusian argument. It stipulates that conditions that prevail today will prevail into the foreseeable future, and the existing technology that we have is insufficient to meet demand of that capacity. And it's always wrong, because it always underestimates the capacity of mankind to engineer itself out of a challenge. None of the population controllers anticipated Norman Borlaug.
Borlaug, yeah.
Borlaug.
Yeah, the Green Revolution that created the famine-resistant and...
there's an actual equation that goes into the amount of yield that we have to generate, increased yield from new technology put into seeds and development of corn and wheat strains, because they have to generate X amount more yield every year. And there's a vast industry dedicated to engineering better, stronger, faster-growing seeds, most of which are under attack by the same people who... obsess over climate change because it's GMOs, and GMOs are bad for some reason.
Oh, it's not just that. It's also this idea that because food is now plentiful, and because therefore we do not live in a planet in which half the people are very close to starvation, we are encouraging the creation of human life, because people no longer are, you know, subsisting entirely. A billion people have been raised from the most penurious and horrible.
But where are those people being born?
Right. But you know,
in the equator.
When you bring up GMOs, though, something interesting happened there, which is, I think, that the argument became pure religion, and then it really kind of lost. I mean,
oh, yeah. But not before it wreaked serious.
Absolutely right. Right.
The worst eugenicist policies perpetrated by this government since World War II in the name of. Population control, and much of it dedicated to the sub-Saharan world and the equatorial world. People with, you know, Puerto Rican women were forced to sterilize themselves. I mean, it was like really horrible things.
Yeah, but there is now no serious mainstream anti-GMO force, really, right?
There isn't?
I don't think so. I mean, maybe I'm overstating this.
Christine,
but
you would know.
I don't know if you
us.
Go through,
but it's not
resident technology.
It could have been the sort of anti CO2 campaign, and it's not. You don't see it on the front pages of newspapers every.
Well,
day.
not in the U.S., but in Europe, certainly. The anti-GMO feeling is very strong, right? I mean, this remains a pretty big difference between our food culture in theirs, among them.
I mean, it is a little crazy, since of course all GMOs are doing is applying Mendelian, Mendelian efforts to plant. You know, this is how plants have been changed and altered over, you know, for millennia, and so.
And they really couldn't find any downside. The only thing, because I used to follow the debate pretty closely, and the only thing that anti-GMO advocates would say. Was that, well, we just don't know yet. We don't know what problems they could come down the line, which is, I guess, factually true.
You know, another story in the New York Times this weekend that I found fascinating on the grounds of where science and politics are commingling in a way that is interesting, if not scandalous or terrible, but you can just rule as you will, was the story about how Juul, the vape pen company, is desperately looking for scientists to do studies of the uses of Juul. And when I say studies, I don't mean they don't care right now what the studies say. They need studies to be done because in 3 years' time, they need to submit some huge packet of evidence to federal authorities that their claim that they are a harm reduction device that gets people to smoke less or, you know, do smoke less tobacco, whatever, is proved. And so they're wandering around America, going to conferences, offering scientists huge sums of money just to do studies. And they say, like, we don't care what the study, if you prove that, you know, we're terrible, that's fine. We just need the studies done, and they cannot get people to do studies.
Well, no one wants to touch Juul because the real question everyone is concerned about is its use by children, and you can't ethically perform a study on children, right? I mean, there is a kind of conundrum here, even for researchers who might be curious. But it's children. I mean, the issue of whether it could be harm-reducing for adults, but it could also be gateway-inducing for children, right? It could be both.
Right.
And but there's no way to ethically study that with children
but in other
subjects.
Words, if someone came, if you're a, a health, whatever we would call sort of a, a macro health person, right? And the Juul comes to you and says, look, I'll give you $1 million. Do a study. Just do a study. If you prove that, we're the worst thing on earth, so be it. Just do it. Take my money and do a study. I'm not going to ask to look at it. I don't want, just do the study. And you go, whoa, I'm not touching that. That's what's interesting. Because what they're saying is something you could obviously be in the contract and everything like that, but that it is now so axiomatic that no one should ever inhale anything that isn't cannabis, apparently, which it seems to be fine.
Although
you're not allowed to question the intake of cannabis anymore, but you are to the intake of something else. That, this is like, as I said to Abe before, it's like if you said, look, I'm from the pedophile industry. Just do a study of pedophile. I don't care if you find it's bad or good. That's the way people are treating this, right? Is it's like that the even asking the question is a surrender to evil, which is striking.
I mean, it's also just a new technology, and every new technology has its Luddites.
Well, that's one way of, or as Christine says, like, in fact, they're not supposed to be marketing to kids, and they claim they're not marketing to kids, and they
have like bubble gum flavors. Of course, they're marketing to kids. Kids are using them.
What, you think grown ups don't have bubble gum? Where are you?
It's a huge thing in middle schools and high schools here in DC. I mean, it's a problem. Kids are using this stuff all the time.
I will say that the last time I was in London, every other human being in London seemed to have some kind of a vape. I mean, that the entire country, the entire city was like one giant vape pen. So obviously, there are adults that are using.
How many were smoking vape pens. Cigarettes when you were there last?
Well, not many, because they were all smoking vapes. Because
before. Were they all smoking cigarettes before? So?
Yeah, well, like in Paris. I didn't see many vape pens in Paris. I just saw like thousands upon thousands of people standing outside bars with vape. It doesn't seem to be like that here. Like, I still see people standing outside of bars smoking cigarettes. I don't see people like smoking vapes outside a bar.
It's funny, but when I see someone smoking here, walking down the street, I do think, oh, how retro.
Yeah.
I expect them to be vaping instead.
It looks very sad to me, like you feel sorry. It's like a person, they always look aggrieved and, they're pariahs. They think they're pariahs. They're either defiant in their pariahdom, or they look ashamed or something like that. It's, talk about a successful act of, moral suasion that looked nominally like it was about health, but I think was about 10,000 different other things. Another change. When I was in college, 55% of people in the United States smoke, and now it's 20%. Okay? So do a straight line projection.
Less than that.
No, I think it's 20%. Do a straight line projection from 1979 to, if you were the Philip Morris company or whoever it was who made you, did you think you were going to have experience a 70% decline in your product?
There are still Boeings sales? Flying with ashtrays in the lavatories.
No, that's true. That's true. I remember when you could smoke on a plane, but you could only smoke in the back because that was going to really gonna keep the
section,
smoke from going up front. Interesting. Okay, so now I've already forgotten what our next topic
Europe.
Is. Oh, right, Europe, where everybody is vaping and either voting green or Nazi or something.
That's why they're so anxious and have to vape all the time, especially in the UK.
So not Nazi, but so the what's interesting is these elections for the European Parliament, a body of absolutely no meaning whatsoever, enormous turnout, 50% turnout. across the European Union. I mean, you know, we can barely get 50%, and now we get about 55% turnout. But I mean, you know how many elections there were in the United States where we didn't get, or congressional elections certainly never get. People are actually turning out to vote for this meaningless parliament. I mean, it's
this, by the way, why high voter turnout isn't a good thing. It is reflective of
poll taxes.
Broad social
Let's have
anxiety.
European Parliament poll taxes. That's what we need. Literacy tests.
It is a reflection of your trepidation with the state of affairs. A non-vote is a vote of confidence.
Okay, so just to take Britain as an interesting example. So the big story there is the utter wipeout of the main parties, right? Of the Tory, but particularly the Tories, right? Who have apparently not performed this badly in any election since 1832, right? So the Tories are the governing party of England. They are of Great Britain. They will likely, with Theresa May's resignation, form a government, probably with Boris Johnson as the prime minister, and go ahead. We've spent now 3 years hearing from every sophisticated person that the vote to leave the European Union and do Brexit was a sham, was a fraud, it was based on lies, it was this, and you know, there should be a second referendum. Okay, if you are a person who believes that there should be a second referendum, do you look at the election that happened over the weekend and say, let's have a second referendum? Here's a great idea. Britain just made the Brexit Party, headed by Farage, the largest British party in the European Parliament. What a great idea to have a second Brexit. You think it's going to do worse than the first Brexit? Hard to say, even if you nominally add the votes up and see that, you know, maybe the Remainers did pretty well. Like, this is a serious shot across the bow of the Tories, and Boris Johnson wrote a piece this morning in which he said, we got to get out of here. We got to do what the voters told us to do. We got to get out, and the getting is good, and have our own sovereignty, or this party is going to go the way of the dodo bird, which is pretty staggering.
So the lesson there for conservatives is that, you know, why would the public support something half measure here when if you're going to get a leave party, you can get it whole from these less savory, more less reputable types?
Apparently. No, I mean, I think it's like, this is a real vote. This is and not just in Britain, but across Europe. This is a real voting tendency. This, you can dismiss it as far right, Nazi, whatever, which is all, nationalist parties that are anti-liberal, anti-globalist, anti-collectivist are now occupying 25-30% of the seats in the European Parliament.
Bret Stephens had a good formulation of this tendency at the end of his column. His recent column, where he described, I can only paraphrase, but he described it as sort of people voting against the them before us idea, and the the voting for the sort of tangible over the intangible, and the immediate over the long term. It was this, it's a sort of a series of impulses where people don't trust the status quo. It's not just nationalist.
But it's an interesting status quo, because it's a status quo that is based on a conception of a better of an intangible future, right? It's not stick with us because of what you have. You keep what you have. It is, we are making all these changes to the way we do things because at some undetermined point in the future, all of these yearnings you have for sovereignty and, you know, and borders and all this, they'll just kind of, you'll stop worrying about it and everything will be a lot better. Mm-hmm. Just, you know, trust us.
Right.
I mean, I think that's where it's different, because ordinarily a status quo party says, don't vote for change because there's going to be too much change. They're saying, we're the status quo party, vote for change that you can't even imagine. It's creating a picture of a post-nation world that you can't even imagine what your place is in it, right? And so My thinking about this is that what we are seeing here is the real collapse of what was never fully a post-Cold War consensus, which you can call the Fukuyama consensus. Not that Frank Fukuyama himself believed this was good or bad, just that he was projecting it, which is, so there's no, at the end of the Cold War, the end of communism means there's no narrative for the future or for to explain our, but sort of liberal democracy in some fashion or other. And so all the nations of the world liberalized to some extent in the 1990s, and then by the end of the 90s, they start bethinking themselves a little bit. Putin comes in Russia, the, you know, various other things happen, and then 9/11 happens, and that kind of shatters. Suddenly we're there's a kind of ideological war in the world, that war stopped seeming as important or winnable or wasn't as big a problem as we thought. And so then we come back to a world in which there's this huge financial meltdown, and there is still no counter narrative to the liberal democracy narrative, as Noah would say. Like, there's a, what else is there?
Well, right? So the criticism I have of the return of history narrative is that it's very sentimental, and we are talking about, which isn't to say it is unimportant, but it is nevertheless, in my view, a little bit cosmetic, because we're not talking about any sort of alternative to the marketplace. That's over. No one is saying, you know, the vastly superior system of societal organization here is the state ownership of the commanding heights of the economy. Nope, no one's saying that. That's done. Even the sort of regulatory models and the Keynesian models that prevailed throughout the 20th century are as dead as the dodo. The regulatory structures we're talking about now are piddling compared to the kind of thing that was the dominant way in which economies structured themselves in order to maximize growth and limit personal sacrifice and suffering on the upside. The consensus there hasn't really been shattered. So what we're really talking about is our relationship to the nation state and sort of conceptual idea of nationalism and society and communitarianism, but not grand societal organization.
Okay, but that makes it worse if you think about it. This is what I mean. So there is no alternative to liberal. In other words, China isn't actually creating a model that anybody else can follow that is a counter model to America. China is very specific to itself. It has its own goals and aims and things it wants to do, but it's not exporting an ideology. It doesn't have an ideology. It doesn't want anything. You know, no one is creating a counter model to liberal democracy, which means that when liberal democracy fails to satisfy people, they don't even have anywhere else to look to say, okay, well, I don't believe in this, I believe in that. So all they can do is stop liberal democracy in some fashion or other.
Well, they do.
The far-right populists who are now, I mean, there's a now established populism in, what, France, Italy, Poland, the UK. I mean, they're established presences now.
And they're not friendly to the market either.
Some are.
The Orban model is to be more socialist than the socialists, to out-socialize them.
Yeah, but not Modi. Like, so in India, where Narendra Modi just won a, you know, overwhelming landslide, which is all being attributed to Hindu nationalism, Modi won a second term because, you know, India had has had an insanely overregulated economy and centralized economy, and Modi actually sought to decentralize it and deregulate it to some extent with apparently astonishing success. So he's complicated because he's like a Hindu nationalist, and that's terrible. And on the other hand, he has actually addressed his nation's failure to become an economic powerhouse on the order of China by going to what we might consider Western policies of denationalization and deregulation and opening up things to the animal spirits of capitalism. So that's an interesting thing.
You sort of dismissed it, but I don't think you should have, insofar as the alternative to liberal democracy in the marketplace exists only in the form of the vision for society advanced by groups like Al-Qaeda and ISIS and the Caliphate. I mean, that was a real competing vision of human social organization that represents a complete break, right, a la Soviet-style communism.
But you know what's so interesting about that? So the war on terror really sort of began as a way to bolster the liberal consensus. You know, this is the sort of the liberal order fighting against its worst enemies, and we will prevail because we are right, and because our system has made us the most powerful, the most strong. And somehow frustrations with that war ended up sort of reverting countries to this nationalist framework instead. After a number of years, the people started saying, "Oh, the hell with this! I don't want to bother. That's over there. I'm worried about mine. Let them do whatever they want."
Well, I think there was a sense that this was not the war on terror and its precepts did not reach the satisfying conclusion, right, that people wished it to reach. You know, there were no right, victory parades. There was no, we kind of stumbled through. We defeated ISIS, but then we didn't, but then we did. It's sort of, it's lingering. Al-Qaeda's kind of gone, but then it came back as ISIS, and we didn't win the war in Iraq, although we didn't. You know, all of that stuff. But this sense that, the current order of societies, the current order of the democratic societies is not satisfying to their electorates. The left doesn't like the inequality and the whatever else, the global warming, and the right doesn't like the secularization and the sense and the atomizing of classical understanding of community, and the sense that they are being lorded over from above by this liberal elite that tramples on their sense of what is right and what is wrong. Right, Christine? Do you?
No, I think that's right. And I think that's the crisis of liberalism, which I think a lot of liberals hoped would be a blip that would be easily resolved, is proving itself, certainly in Europe and in the U.S. as well, to not be easily resolvable. Part of that, look, I mean, conservatives have a challenge too. Conservatives have to find a way to deal with populism and to deal with this new breed of nationalism and xenophobia. And I don't, so far, we haven't seen conservative leadership do that very well. But the question of whether liberalism is built to last, as it were, is still up in the air. I don't think there is a decisive answer to that. And I think the fact that people who voted in these elections feel like they really aren't getting heard still by their leaders, and this was yet another attempt to be heard.
If I can pull out my old Straussian training from my undergraduate days at the University of Chicago,
please.
Studying with Alan Bloom. Alan Bloom, you know, translated and taught Plato's Republic, and Plato's Republic begins, the first book of Plato's Republic begins with a debate over what is important. Is the good important or one's own? And there's a character, a sort of bourgeois burgher named Cephalus. And Cephalus's argument is he has to do what's right for his family, his children, everything like that. And Socrates says, no, what is important is the good in general, right? And this is the conflict that the book seeks to resolve, and that Socrates then lays out this image of the perfect society, the Republic, which is an uncomfortably totalitarian world, the purpose of which is to protect the philosopher from being killed, right? So what's interesting about this is that this is precisely the battle, not that I'm saying that Trump was a student of Alan Bloom's, but so the Democratic Party or the liberal America, not leftist America, but sort of liberal America believes in the good, right? So it's like, be nice to everybody. So you're nice to your fellow citizens, but you also have to be nice to immigrants, whether they're legal or illegal. You treat them with, you do everything you can for them just as you would for anybody else. And the other argument is, no, we're a country. We take care of our own first. We are responsible to our own first, to protecting our own first. And after that, we can do what we have to do for others. And in general, this, you know, the left kind of stumbled into this idea that there was nothing specific or necessary to the defense of the United States as a sovereign entity, let's say, you know, in which a citizen of the United States is more important to the future of the United States than somebody who wishes to come to the United States. And so that sort of like their sort of Platonism as opposed to the sort of Catholicism of the right, this is the fight that goes on in every single country, and particularly in Europe, where literally countries have surrendered their borders and their sovereignty to Brussels, which is what the entire argument in England is about, is are we our own country? Are we not our own country in Britain? Are we ourselves, or are we simply going to be a large part of something larger? And we don't, and a lot of people there are happy to be a large part of something larger, and a lot of people there do not want to be a large part of something larger. I mean,
one of the philosophical arguments in favor of supranational integrationism was that it was insurance against national decline, that you were essentially setting the rules of the road on your terms so that when history inevitably made a comeback and other powers rose and you declined, that you would essentially be codifying your way of life into something that would represent, you know, a system that would continue moving forward even if you did not.
Okay, let me take a break here and talk to you guys about Harry Shave, our old friend, whose founders were tired of paying up for razors that were overpriced and overdesigned. They knew a great shave doesn't come from gimmicks like vibrating heads, flex balls, or handles that look like spaceships, tactics that the leading brand has used to raise prices for decades. They fixed that by combining a simple, clean design with quality, durable blades at a fair price. Harry's bought a world-class blade factory in Germany that's been making quality blades for over 95 years. They've received over 20,000 five-star reviews on Trustpilot and Google. Its replacement cartridges are just $2 each. So that's half the price of the Gillette Fusion Pro Shield. And the blades come with a 100% quality guarantee. I use it. I used it this morning. Got a beautiful, nice, close shave, and I enjoy it very much. So join the 10 million who have tried Harry's like me. Claim your trial offer by going to harrys.com/commentary. Get a $13 value trial set that comes with everything you need for a close, comfortable shave. Weighted ergonomic handle, 5-blade razor with a lubricating strip and trimmer blade, rich lathering shave gel, travel blade cover. Listeners of our show can redeem their trial set at harrys.com/commentary. Make sure you go to harrys.com/commentary to redeem your offer and let them know we sent you to help support the show.
Can I chime in with one thought?
Please.
One of the other ideals of the sort of establishment liberalism in Europe was that it was also understood to protect minorities. And as we saw in the news over the weekend, in Germany, there was this statement by government officials telling Jews that they couldn't guarantee their protection and perhaps they shouldn't wear a kippah, they shouldn't wear their head covering, because that marked them in such a way that they might be at risk. And so I think the whole discussion of, you know, what kind of response there can be to, you know, far-right populism and xenophobia, there has to be a similar discussion going on about what protections the sort of European liberalism will be able to continue to offer to the minorities in its midst, and what open border policy means in that context, because certainly in Germany it has meant much greater danger for Jews living in that country.
I'm not sure a rising nationalism in Germany is an especially good bulwark against
well, that's for sure. But in this case, it's not nationalism that is the danger. This is an attack by a minority on another minority, which is not what is imagined in the kind of romantic idea of the world in which the minorities are all protected. Because the idea is that all minorities have the same requirement of getting some kind of a sense of protection from the government, not that they will turn on each other, or that, you know, Muslims will in Germany seek to duplicate their, you know, grander religio-ideological fight against Jewish people, you know, on, you know, having just come off refugee boats from Syria. Like, maybe they should just go get a job, keep their heads down, and stop attacking people.
Don't they understand intersectionality?
Oh, they do.
Yes.
Clearly.
Clearly they do. So with that, we will bring this crushingly morose episode to a close. We're back to crushing morosity. It's been a couple of years.
We did it.
We did it.
Goals. Oh, this is by the way, we should give ourselves a little pat on the back. This is our 301st episode. Last one was our 300th
episode. Wow.
So when they say years, he means it.
Yeah, we need to make that clear to Jonah Goldberg, who's always celebrating. It's like this is his 105th episode. This is his 87th episode. You know, maybe when he gets to a point where he's like at around 300, maybe he can then cite. You know, it's a nice niche podcast he has there, and I think he should probably have a little modesty about these landmark achievements. So with that, for Abe Greenwald, Noah Rothman, and Christine Rosen, I'm John Podhoretz. Keep the candle burning.